That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Participation trophies, 13th place finisher ribbons, scoreless soccer matches, and it is an honor just to be nominated. In the push for a kinder, gentler society, it seems that everyone's a winner. But while we don't yet know the result of this election day, two things are certain. There will be winners and there will be losers. And that's what today's show is all about. We'll explore winning and losing in the natural world throughout history and how it affects the brain. Dr. Ian Robertson is a neuroscientist and chair in psychology at Trinity College in Dublin, who studies the way the brain responds to winning and losing. He explored that in an extremely popular TED Talk and wrote about his findings in the book The Winner Effect: The Neuroscience of Success and Failure. Ian Robertson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, we're talking to you on a special day here in the U.S. when we determine winners and losers in a very clear fashion. Are the successors and the not-so-successful so clear in the natural world?
Well, to an extent they are, although, you know, one day you can be a winner and the next day you can be a loser. That being said, the game is rather biased because most animals, including humans, create hierarchies, which can be quite stable. And the higher you are up the hierarchy, the more likely it is you are going to win, and vice versa for losers.
And what is the most significant factor in determining whether a person is successful or not?
The best predictor of success is previous successes. And that's what the winner effect is. It's true of humans, but it's true of most animal species as well.
Why does the winner effect take shape, and how? In the body or the brain?
Well, unfortunately, we can't delve in the same detail into human brains that we can into animal brains. But when we study animal brains, when they win, you get a surge of testosterone. And that testosterone, this is both females and males, that testosterone increases the number of receiving stations, receptors for testosterone and similar hormones, so that the next time they have a contest and they get a surge of testosterone, that testosterone will have a bigger effect. And what happens to the brain is you get more motivation and more aggression. So the primary mechanism of the winner effect seems to be on motivation and aggression.
And conversely, somebody who has lost previously, they would not get the same rise in testosterone.
They won't have the surge. Even chess players before a contest, male or female, will show an increase in testosterone before the contest. And the bigger that increase in testosterone, the greater the probability is that they will win, all other things being equal. The converse is that if you haven't had the benefit of previous successes, then you won't have benefited from these surges of testosterone, and so you won't get the supercharging of your brain, if you like, that is consequent on success.
So is being a winner, is it always the same as sort of coming in first?
Coming in first, if your motivation is always to be first, that is a pretty precarious kind of motivation to have in life, because there's always in the world someone better than you. And so what having that kind of motivation to be first is sometimes considered to be a less authentic type of motivation. And even though coming first, getting a gold medal at the Olympics, for instance, or getting the Nobel Prize, produces an enormous benefit to you in your brain and your body, there are not many times, and you cannot guarantee always coming first. So a much more stable and healthier source of the winner effect is to set goals for yourself, to have goals which are personal and which are meaningful and which are more authentic. And that means you can create for yourself lots of little winner effects, success experiences, which you can benefit from, even though you may not be top of the tree in terms of objective performance.
Well, and as you said, you can't always win. Losing is built into politics, for example. Politicians lose. So how do they bounce back from that? How do they get that momentum again?
What happens is people who don't have that capacity to pick themselves up after a defeat and to come back, they don't make it through the early stages of politics. There's no politician has not had defeats. And so you're selecting out people with a particular appetite for, particularly for power. And that appetite for power can be enough of a fuel, if you like, to keep you going through the low periods and even the periods of having lost or being defeated.
So the brain chemistry must actually change to keep that going. So the brain chemistry of a politician would be different from, say, a public radio host, for example.
Well, that's an interesting question. And no one's done the study of these particular two people. But what we do know is this. People who have a big appetite for power, who enjoy power, and that's true for most politicians. So what we know about people with a high appetite for power is that when they win, they get a much bigger surge of testosterone. And that has downstream effects on their brain, on the dopamine levels in their brain, for instance. And they benefit from winning more than someone with a lower appetite for power. If they lose, they hate losing because they get a big surge of the hormone cortisol, which is the stress hormone. And that really... Where people, for instance, people with a low appetite for power who don't make good politicians, the people with the extreme end of that spectrum, they actually find winning stressful and they get a surge of cortisol when they win.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, this difference between the stress hormone and the sort of puffed up hormone, because in populist politics here, there's been a lot of talk of the game being rigged, you know, that momentum is behind the wealthy, the well-connected, the successful, in other words. Now, knowing what you know about brain chemistry and biology, is there any truth to that?
I suspect there is a considerable truth to it. There is evidence the steeper the socioeconomic hierarchy, then the greater the benefits for those higher up that hierarchy, and the greater the disadvantages of people lower in the hierarchy. And there have even been studies showing that people lower down the socioeconomic scale have actually lower dopamine levels in their brain. And that actually, lower dopamine levels equates to less capacity for bold action, for taking initiatives, and even reduces, saps mental function to a certain extent. So yes, having the silver spoon in your mouth will definitely make you more liable to be successful. And that is a feature of some societies more than others. It has its upsides and its good sides towards in the line of rewarding enterprise, etc. But it also has its downside in terms of steadily increasing a hierarchy that may exist already.
We're talking about the neuroscience of winners and losers and successes and failures with Ian Robertson. He's author of the book, The Winner Effect, and also chair in psychology at Trinity College in Dublin. Maybe you've seen his TED Talk on The Winner Effect. We know, you know, a surge of dopamine in the body feels good. Drugs do that, or extreme exercise. Testosterone probably feels good. So does early success in one's life make one hungrier for even more success? Are they sort of chasing that feeling?
Well, that's an interesting question because it depends on what you make of that success. If you are told, for instance, supposing you're a very blessed young man or woman who has every fortune, but you are told you're very clever, you're very bright, you can adapt and create a theory of your own abilities, which is called an entity theory or a fixed theory, which says, well, I am all these wonderful things, not through my own action, but because I was born this way. Now, that is fine so long as you don't hit any adversity. But what happens is if you have a failure experience or you fail an exam or you flunk college or you get rejected by someone, that can leave you with very impoverished resilience, because what that means is if all these attributes are given to you, then if you come up with evidence that you don't have these, if you've just failed, for instance, the conclusion is, oh, maybe I'm not bright, or maybe I'm not attractive, or maybe I'm not successful. Whereas another person who does conceive of their abilities as being part endowed, but also part due to their own efforts and to the environment, they're better able to ride through setbacks or adversity.
I'm thinking about that saying, you know, fake it till you make it. Obviously, your brain chemistry may not be willing to do that. But is there any way that we can sort of pretend, project ourselves as winners to change the results?
So, yes, there are astonishing findings that if you adopt the posture that a powerful person would typically adopt, you know, erect stance, occupying space, maybe hands on your hips, or kind of spread eagle, you know, lounging back in the chair as the CEO might do when interviewing a junior member of the company. That is space-occupying behaviour. In all species, not just humans, that kind of dominance posture, sometimes called a power pose, if you get people to take up such a pose without having any of the mental, the thoughts and the feelings to go with it, but just fake the power pose, you trick the brain into assuming that it is more dominant. And as a result, it secretes more testosterone, and it also creates more dopamine in the brain. And dopamine is part of the reward network, which makes you feel in charge. It makes you feel more bold and more confident. And so you can actually, as you said, fake it till you make it by adopting the external trappings of success and dominance. And you can actually, the evidence is, perform better in interviews, for instance, if you behave as if you are not the quaking jelly inside, which you actually feel like.
They say, of course, that winning is not everything. Is that true? Is that all that we care about, is winning, even if we don't think we do?
There's very few people who don't get a thrill at winning. The most secure kind of winning is winning vis-a-vis your own goals, achieving things you've set for yourself. But nevertheless, many people no one would not feel delighted to be given the Nobel Prize or to get a gold medal at the Olympics. I mean, I guess there are some very enlightened people, religious people who have transcended that and who have escaped from the mortal coil of trying to achieve, but there's very, very few of us manage to do this. And the secret is to try and create for ourselves a world we benefit from success experiences. And best way to do that is to have goals for ourselves which are our own goals relative to our own aspirations, and not ranking goals vis-a-vis other people, because if you're low down in the social hierarchy, then you're going to continually experience failure experiences, and that's not good for any brain.
Dr. Ian Robertson, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ian Robertson, neuroscientist and chair in psychology at Trinity College in Dublin. You'll find a link to his book, The Winner Effect, as well as his TED Talk, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we will continue our exploration of winners and losers in the world of sports, what it takes to win in the boxing ring. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And on this election day, we are dedicating our show to winners and losers. Like politics, the world of sports is a place where wins and losses are clearly defined. But what goes on in the minds of athletes as they battle for the win? Kelly Carswell visited the Portland Boxing Club in Maine to find out.
Before that bell rings and I'm warming up with my coach and just getting ready, my adrenaline is going, my heart is pounding.
Lisa Caronia is a boxer. In the past year, she's won both a national and world title. But But even after all that success, she's still convinced she'll never be calm in the few minutes just before a fight.
I always think to myself, why the hell am I doing this? What am I doing? What am I thinking? This is going to be my last fight. I say that every time before a match.
You're just staring this guy down. You know, I don't know. It's a really odd moment of confrontation with another person.
Jed Coffin is an amateur boxer. He's fought in 6 fights. He says the moments before the first bell rings are among the most surreal he's ever had.
I think for a brief moment, you're going to want to pull out. You're going to want to not be in there. And the experience of maybe losing in front of a crowd and not having anyone to hide behind is something that you pretty much would want to stay away from in most walks of life.
I think still to this day, it's a little scary getting in there. You know, it takes a lot of courage to get in there, and the possibility that you may get pounded into the ground and, you know, look a little humiliated, it's a scary thing mentally. No one wants to be defeated.
Amateur boxers train for their fights day after day, for months. They train and train so that when they pass through the ropes, their body and mind run on instinct and calculation. Lisa and Jed train at the Portland Boxing Club. They are members of a team of fighters coached by Bob Russo, the club's owner and patriarch.
Boxing being the most, the toughest sport, you tend not to cheat and not to skip training and so on because you're afraid you're going to get beat. I would think that you'd want to train harder in this sport than you would in anything else because of the consequences.
Bob says certain things have to happen robotically in a fight, like the way you move your feet, your sense of balance, how you react to different punches. Developing boxing instinct takes a lot of repetition and a lot of time. The boxers are at the club 4 to 5 days a week for 3 hours. They hit speed bags, heavy bags, and double end bags. They shadow box in the mirror and spar in the ring. They do the same exercises over and over. With sweat accumulating on his forehead, Jed works on the heavy bag.
This is mostly for strength.
I still am not throwing a jab right. I've been working on it for 2 years, you know. And I mean, maybe in the street I could knock some guy out, but just to learn how to throw an uppercut so that you're throwing with more than just your shoulder or your bicep, but actually throwing with your legs and your stomach and your core. That stuff takes years and years.
I am hitting the double end bag. I work on not telegraphing my jab when I throw it, being able to move, bob and weave. There's so many components in boxing that I realize that I have to perfect. I think it'll take a lifetime to ever feel like I've completely dominated the sport.
By day, Lisa is an environmental scientist. Jed is a writer. They fill much of their free time with training. Boxing is like a second job that they don't get paid for. It's a lifestyle.
I spend probably half of my day boxing or training for boxing and the other half working.
When she's training for a fight, Lisa's up at 5 in the morning for her first workout of the day, usually running. She maintains a strict diet, no pizza and beer, and she has to cut down on socializing so she's always well-rested. And then there's the mental side of the game. Some of the mental conditioning happens in the gym when they're sparring.
First time you get in there and you're trying to remember what you're supposed to do, and you know mentally you know this person's going to come at you, have a potential of getting hurt, you're not sure exactly what it's like to be hit. It's a hard thing to condition yourself to.
I think there are people who have minds that can sort of comprehend that level of punishment, people who are just completely flattened by it. I think it just is a way your mind can work with your body.
You have to be as mentally strong in order to do this. And again, it's not something that is spoken with boxing a lot, but it's very, very intelligent. It's really a physical chess game.
3 or 4 days before a fight, the training ends. Bob wants his fighters to be well-rested for the ring.
Bring home the bacon.
Finally, it's fight night. Outside the ring, Bob wraps his fighters' hands. He uses this time before the fight to talk strategy. He is the voice of years of experience. He tells his fighter how to beat their opponent. While he'll be in the corner throughout the fight, this is his last chance to focus his boxers before they step into the ring alone.
And just certain things to try to put a bug in their ear about certain approaches. A couple of key points that I want them to remember kind of drive that home. if you really know the game, you know how to, you know, play the physical chess part of it. You can make your opponent do things. And you're so, thus you're setting traps for them.
And so you see it's really a thinking thing. You know, it's really meditative to get in there and breathe right and think right and not to, you know, try to put knockout power on every punch. Then to be mindful of what punch needs to come next and to be mindful of how you're going to approach sort of each moment of the fight. During a fight, you have to be able to really calm yourself or you're going to just gas out.
But I go back and I think of all of those times that I sacrificed, those times where I didn't go out on a Friday night, those times where I ate a salad instead of pizza, those times where at 5:30 in the morning I was on my fourth mile of running.
You have to own up to the fact that in the next 6 minutes that you got to do something that you've been practicing for years. And if you don't do it right, you're probably going to lose. And if you don't do it right, you're going to feel bad about yourself. And so moment you put that at stake, it's pretty scary.
All right, now boxing out of the red corner, representing the Portland Boxing Club.
I just tell myself, you know what, no one has prepared as much as I have. And when I think that way mentally, I think, well, how can anyone possibly beat me if I've trained harder than all of my opponents?
For Salt Radio, this is Callie Carswell.
Okay, it's Election Day, and today's word of mouth is all about winners and losers. We'll return with an examination of who dominates in the natural world through the complicated parasite-host relationship. That's after the news from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. How's this for a horror show? Invaders so cunning they can bore into a body and compel it to do their bidding. We're talking blood-sucking interlopers that can take over and force creatures to act against their own instincts, surrendering their very bodies as habitats, giving over reproduction, even plunging to their own deaths. This is not a pitch for yet another zombie movie or TV series. These mind-controlling hijackers are real. Science writer and New York Times columnist Carl Zimmer wrote about current research on parasites, which can control the behavior of their hosts, turning them into kind of sacrificial vessels for their own parasitic survival. His article is called Nature's Nightmare Mind Suckers, and it is the cover story on the National Geographic. Carl Zimmer, great to speak with you again.
Thanks for having me.
So some of the things that parasites can make a critter do, I just mentioned, some very horrific stories. One of the most chilling is how the parasitic wasp takes over the spotted lady beetle. What can you tell us?
There are many species of wasps that actually are parasites, which might seem strange to us because we think of wasps as just flying around and being free living. But the fact is that they will use hosts as nurseries, as places where they will lay their eggs. And so there's one example where there is one of these wasps that makes a ladybug its host. And so it stings it and injects an egg. And then the egg hatches and then grows into a larva inside the living ladybug. And the parasite grows, and it grows, and it grows. And then finally, it comes out, and it's now time for the larva to make itself basically a cocoon. But the thing is, it's very vulnerable at this point. So it's actually altered the ladybug's behavior so much that now the ladybug doesn't just go away. It actually sticks around and acts as a bodyguard. It fights off any other insects that might come along and try to eat the parasite in its cocoon.
Some of the other tormenting parasites that you talk about also, it becomes like an ultimate Stockholm syndrome, right? You know, you're sort of taking something captive and you end up protecting it. The jewel wasp, another wasp that sort of takes over. What does it do?
So the jewel wasp, what it does is it attacks cockroaches. So what it does is it first swoops down on a cockroach and inserts its stinger into the cockroach's sort of the middle of its body, basically. And it hits the nerves there so that now the cockroach can't walk. It's basically paralyzed temporarily. So that way the wasp doesn't have to fight with the cockroach when it does the really complicated procedure, which is it then takes its stinger and places the stinger inside the cockroach's brain where it can deliver a cocktail of chemicals. And these chemicals then have a long-term effect on the cockroach's behavior. So after it recovers from the paralysis, it now essentially has lost its drive. It can walk, it can run, but it just doesn't want to. It just doesn't have any initiative. And now what the wasp does is it literally it grabs onto one of the cockroach's antenna and pulls on it, kind of like a dog on a leash, into a burrow that it's dug. And in that burrow, it sticks an egg on the underside of the cockroach, and then the wasp climbs out and it seals the burrow shut. At any point in this process, the cockroach could have run away. It's alive. Its muscles are working. Its nervous system is working. It's just been altered. And then the egg hatches and the larva crawls inside the cockroach and then grows and it actually bursts out of the cockroach's body. The cockroach dies. The wasp crawls out of the burrow and flies away.
We can hear the theremin music.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But they're so strategic and wily. You know, there are these tiny worms and viruses that know that they need to get into a bird stomach or a cat stomach in order to thrive. So they disable or cripple their host as a mere vehicle. They destroy their instinct. How does this happen? Or why?
Well, I mean, it's the product of evolution. And so through, you know, many, many generations, you get the sort of fine tuning of manipulating their environment. And, you know, all animals can manipulate their environment in one way or the other. You know, beavers make dams, for example, and they will, you know, create, you know, huge ponds that are very good for, you know, change the whole ecosystem. And, you know, those also make the environment good for the beaver itself. And so you could say, like, well, how on earth could a beaver know to do this? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, because it's got genes that have been modified, and so that now its brain generates this behavior to build a dam. So parasites are the same way, except that instead of building a dam, they're basically making the behavior of other animals their sort of raw material.
Okay, so if this is all about evolution and adaptation, why does the evolution of the parasite trump the evolutionary advantages of the host?
Well, you know, we shouldn't be too unfair to the host. I mean, they are, you know, if they can evolve a defense so that they don't get killed by parasites, then they're going to have a lot more offspring than the hosts that do get parasitized. And so there is actually a lot of defense that hosts have against parasites. So, for example, when wasps try to lay their eggs inside of ladybugs, ladybugs actually have very strong immune systems, and they will attack the egg. They'll try to basically suffocate it. But, you know, then that kind of defense then creates an opportunity for parasites to evolve a new counterattack. And so you have this sort of back and forth, a kind of an arms race between parasites and their hosts. And that is one of the explanations for how parasites get to be so kind of elaborate and almost crazy in the way that they can control their hosts, because they're in this race and they're evolving very fast, and they've been doing so for millions of years. Mm.
So, okay, baculoviruses that can turn caterpillars into goo, flatworms that can grow deformed limbs on bullfrogs. Looking at these stories, was there anyone in particular that just really struck you with its ingenuity?
Oh, I can remember the first example I ever heard of parasites manipulating their hosts. It was when I was actually working on a whole book on parasites called Parasite Rex. And it was this amazing case where ants get infected by a fungus. And, you know, you don't think of funguses as being terribly sophisticated. You just think of mushrooms. But the fact is that if a spore gets on an ant, it germinates and it kind of drills down inside the ant's body, and it starts to grow all of these tendrils inside of its body, and it feeds on it. Some of those tendrils go into its brain, and something very weird happens. It starts crawling up, and it crawls up to a leaf, and it'll go to the underside of the leaf and clamp down on it. And then, and only then, the fungus shoots up this stalk out of its body. The ant is dead at this point, but now the fungus is in exactly where it wants to be to shower down spores on other ants below. So it basically uses the ant to get to a place where it can be more likely to complete its cycle. The first time I heard about that, I just thought it was just some kind of science fiction story. I just couldn't believe it.
Well, speaking of the science fiction story, have you ever heard of parasites taking over a human brain in a similar way or compelling a human being to act on its behalf?
Yeah, that's always the big question with these things. You know, it's one thing, I guess, you know, to manipulate an ant or a cockroach, but, you know, what about people? I think the evidence is still very preliminary, and part of the reason for that is that, you know, it's hard to do research on people in this way. I mean, scientists can raise thousands of wasps and ladybugs and observe the behavior and see what happens if you adjust things a little bit. We just don't do that with people, thank goodness. But there are some interesting parasites. So there's one that's called Toxoplasma, and people get it from handling kitty litter or get it in contaminated soil or raw meat. It's a single-celled parasite, and its normal cycle is in the wild. Its host is cats, where it reproduces and produces eggs. Then the cat sheds them with their droppings. And then the toxoplasma then gets into animals like rats. And when the rats get eaten by cats, then the parasite gets back to where it started and can reproduce again. When rats get infected with toxoplasma, something very startling happens. They're healthy for the most part, but they lose their fear of cats. And in some cases, it looks as if they're actually attracted to the smell of cats. And so the thinking is that this might raise the odds that the parasite can get into a cat and then be able to reproduce. Now, there are a lot of studies going on to see what happens when toxoplasma gets into people. It does look like there are some personality differences between people who have toxoplasma and people who don't.
So I guess despite the baffling ingenuity of some of these parasites, they don't win out always. There's not a clear winner or loser. I mean, we still have rats, we still have cats, and we still also have this virus that bores into them.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, any species that still managing to be alive today is something of a winner, you know, because it exists. If you look at the number of species on Earth, the number of species of parasites vastly outnumbers the number of species of hosts.
Huh.
So the parasites have won.
Carl Zimmer, science writer and New York Times columnist, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Carl Zimmer wrote the cover story for the National Geographic, Nature's Nightmare Mind Suckers. You'll find a link to the article and those spectacular photos at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we're trying our best to stay out of the political fray today, but we are going to dip our toes in just a bit with an historical look at political losers. That's capital L, losers. The tricky art of conceding a political race when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. So far, our show on winners and losers has steered well clear of politics. We'll all be getting our fill of the horse races as the day and night grind on, after all. We're continuing our attempt to stay above the contemporary partisan fray with the ghostly victors and vanquished of elections past. Brady Carlson is with us. In addition to being NHPR's host of All Things Considered, Brady is Word of Mouth's sometime awesomeator and is hard at work on his forthcoming book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. Brady, always great to have you with us.
Always great to be with you.
So having introduced that, I'm going to completely flip this. We're going to lose the winners. We know enough about them. So let's talk about the political losers. First, a memorable phrase from what sounds like a pretty sore loser.
I leave you, gentlemen, now. And you will now write it, you will interpret it, that's your right. But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Richard Nixon there, and who would be go on to be kicked around and do some kicking himself for some time. So what's the story there, Brady? What was he talking about?
Well, he was talking to the press, which, of course, is ironic because we all remember the warm feelings that the press and Nixon had for each other. This particular speech was in 1962. Nixon had lost the presidential race in 1960. 2 years later, he ran for governor of California, and he lost that race to the incumbent Edmund Pat Brown, whose son is now governor of California. And as he congratulates Brown, he starts noting all of the things that he's proud of in doing in the race. And as he notes each of these things, he says, now, of course, you didn't report that, and you didn't report that, and you didn't report that. So he's turning his concession speech into kind of an indictment of the media and the way it was covering his campaign, which he thought was highly unfair. So he said after these two big losses, he was politically finished, and he said, the reporters are going to miss me when I'm gone.
He said it was his last press conference ever. So it's a memorable concession speech.
Highly.
Any standout concession speeches, either historic or contemporary?
There was a famous concession speech actually in New Hampshire during our presidential primary in 1988. This was a Republican contest between Vice President George H.W. Bush and Kansas Senator Bob Dole. Bush won that race, and it was very contentious. And when asked if he had anything to say to Bush about the vote, Dole growled, yeah, tell him to stop lying about my record.
But couldn't we make the argument, Brady, that that is somehow more honest? You know, I mean, we think about the campaign season, all these slings and arrows and barbs and accusations and animosity exchanged between the candidates.
And then all of a sudden they're being nice to each other.
Pling, you know, I called my honorable opponent and, you know, offered my congratulations, you know, then they're all gracious about it.
Yeah, I think it has to do with the fact that for the people who aren't winners in these races, this is their last chance to speak to their prospective constituents. And in most cases, you want to put a good face on that, especially if you're thinking 2 or 4 years down the road that you might be back. You don't want to leave people with the image that that then Vice President Nixon left in 1962, where it was a very, you know, he sounded bitter and he sounded upset and he sounded a little too angry for people's tastes. You basically don't want to give people an excuse to not vote for you or not like you somewhere else down the road. And even in Nixon's case, it worked out in the end. After 6 years, he wound up running again and as the new Nixon and ended up being president.
Okay, so let's hear a sore loser. This is former New Jersey gubernatorial candidate Barbara Buono. She lost in that race to Governor Chris Christie, who, let's say, outpaced her by many, many points even going into the race.
The Democratic political bosses, some elected and some not, made a deal with this governor, despite him representing everything they're supposed to be against. They didn't do it to help the state. They did it out of a desire to help themselves politically and financially.
Okay, so that's a not such a great concession speech. She's blaming her own party for her loss. How about memorable, good, heartwarming, gracious concession speeches?
Sometimes these concession speeches really can convince you that even in the nastiest of political campaigns, sometimes there's still something good going on in the American political system. I mean, most recently, there was the example of 2008 when John McCain won a lot of praise for his concession speech in the presidential race. McCain pointed out that this was a historic election, that Barack Obama, an African-American, was now going to be president of the United States. And he was thinking just about a century before that, the incumbent president, Teddy Roosevelt, had invited Booker T. Washington to the White House. And there was a firestorm of controversy just about having that the president had lunch at the White House with an African-American. And here there was going to be an African-American who lived in the White House. And he was pointing out that no matter who you supported, that was a really big and exciting moment for the country.
America today is a world away from the cruel and prideful bigotry of that time. There is no better evidence of this than the election of an African-American to the presidency of the United States. Let there be no reason now. Let there be no reason now for any American to fail to cherish their citizenship in this, the greatest nation on earth.
John McCain there, keeping it classy in 08 during his concession speech. Brady, it reminds me, did you see that movie, the Netflix documentary Mitt, that followed Mitt Romney on his campaign for president?
No, I didn't see it.
Okay, because there's a moment in there where they're at his hotel room and he's surrounded by his family, and it strikes him that he's not even thought. He so thought he was going to win that he didn't even consider writing a concession speech. Let's listen to a clip from that.
So what do you say if we, what do you think you say in a concession speech? Let me read you what I have here at Suits and Thank. Just help President Obama to congratulate him on his victory. His supporters and his campaign also deserve congratulations. I wish all of them well, particularly the President, the First Lady, and their daughters. This is a time of great challenges for America, and I pray that the President will be successful in guiding the nation.
I was following.
You know, everybody just looks dazed and blank, which I guess on some level could bring that kind of idea of thinking like a winner, you know, so positively that you don't even consider that you might lose.
Yeah, if you're spending time writing the speech about what happens when you lose, you're not spending time trying to win the election. I mean, everybody thought that Harry Truman in 1948 was behind in his bid for re-election against the Republican candidate, the governor of New York, Thomas Dewey. But Truman said, I'm getting to work. I'm not conceding a single vote, and I'm not writing a concession speech, and he ended up winning. There was that famous moment where he got off the train in Chicago and he held up the famously wrong headline of the Tribune that said Dewey defeats Truman. He figures, well, I don't have time to write a concession speech.
Okay, so after the concession speech, you're just the loser walking among us. And I hate to say it like that, but in politics, you have winners and losers. How about happy losers? Anybody really benefit from not becoming president?
Some candidates have actually walked away from the process and found a whole new life after politics that they've wound up enjoying more. The classic example that comes to mind for me is William Howard Taft. He ran for re-election against his former mentor, friend, and former president, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Democrat Woodrow Wilson. Wilson wound up winning the election. And Taft, of those three candidates, finished a distant third. And he joked not long after the election, he says, I've been elected ex-president by the largest margin in history. And he actually found that being outside of politics agreed with him very much. His health improved. He lost a lot of weight. He spent a lot of time teaching at law schools. Then he ended up getting the job that he really always wanted instead of the presidency. He wound up being Chief Justice of the United States. So he wound up enjoying himself very much. He even reconciled with Teddy Roosevelt in time.
Teddy Roosevelt, however, not such a graceful loser.
Not particularly. Not when a man says things like, we stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord. You don't give up that easily.
Any other beautiful losers?
John Quincy Adams had a very difficult presidency. John Quincy Adams won the White House in a very contested election over Andrew Jackson, who then vowed that the election had been stolen and that he would spend every waking moment trying to ruin Adams' presidency, which he did. Adams lost the rematch to Jackson, but he very quickly found a new niche as a member of Congress from Massachusetts. He wound up being kind of an early anti-slavery voice in the country. He was, by virtue of being a former president, able to say things that a lot of other politicians couldn't say. So there was a gag rule that they refused. At that time, the House had refused to even consider any bills about slavery. Adams got that lifted. He was the lawyer in the Supreme Court case, in the Amistad case, where the escaped slaves wound up winning their freedom and wound up becoming a very esteemed figure who wound up loving the combat, so to speak, of politics at that level instead of being somewhat out of it, isolated in the White House.
Well, you know, when we talk about partisanship in American politics, a lot of people go back to the election of 1876. Now, Brady, maybe it's too soon to really dig into this one.
Well, this one makes the 1876 election made the Bush v. Gore contest in 2000 look very mild-mannered. There was talk at some point that we might have a second civil war because the election got so crazy. There was vote rigging and stealing and all kinds of nefarious activity going on between the Republican candidate Rutherford B. Hayes and the Democrat Samuel Tilden. In the end, Rutherford B. Hayes wound up winning, and that's why we remember his beard and we remember nothing about Samuel Tilden. Even though Tilden won the popular vote, Tilden liked to joke later on that he had the benefit of having won the presidency without ever having to have the responsibilities of serving. But there is a slight bitter note because his grave in New York State has a very pointed epitaph that says, "I still trust the people."
Brady Carlson, NHPR's All Things Considered host. He's currently on deadline to deliver his forthcoming book. It is called Dead Presidents, an American Adventure. It just hasn't been published yet. We have a list of our memorable winners, losers, and concession speeches at wordofmouthradio.org.
So I'm a loser, baby.
Thank you so much for your listening time on this very busy election day. If you have not yet hit the polls, hop to it. After all, it is your vote that could determine who wins and who loses. And to those candidates who do win, Charlie Sheen has some advice for you.
Good luck. You're going to need it. I'm going to be over here, like, winning.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Here at Word of Mouth, we think you are all winners. Hope you agree. And join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The folk singer's club. He hung himself with a guitar string. A slab of turkey neck and it's hanging from a pigeon wing. Get right if you can't relate. Trade the cash for the beat, for the body, for the hate. And my time is a piece of wax falling on a termite who's choking on the splinters.